Technorama episode 557, Somewhere Over the Einstein-Rosen Bridge. And you're probably wondering, why is that starting so short? It's because I went to the Phoenix Podcaster Meetup that is organized every third Thursday by the one and only Evo Terra. Let me start out back where we're going here. Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes on... Yeah, we're doing really good. They messed me up already.
Welcome what are you
to
doing?
Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you are joining us for the first time, welcome. Welcome to you. It is great to have you joining us. If you are returning, thank you for coming back. My name is Chuck Tomasi from sunny Phoenix, Arizona, and joining me right across that virtual table is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
Hey, don't call me short.
Did I say short? No, I didn't say short in there anywhere.
No, your intro. You said short.
Yes, the intro has been shortened up based on feedback. We also have our wonderful video engineer. My lovely wife, Donna, is at the helm. So she's changing cameras and scenery. Got her own sound effect. We're going to use that from now on. And
in the morning when you say, good morning, Donna. Ding.
Right. Level up. And we're not going to say anything about mushrooms getting bigger. So we'll leave it at that. The podcast meetup in Phoenix this past Thursday, we had one gentleman said, and he wasn't referring to our show specifically. He said, I was listening to a podcast and the intro was a minute and a half before he actually heard the announcer's voice. Now, I know ours gets about that. I think our intro song is about 90 seconds after you get through all the Technorama. And we have been using that since 2006. So almost 13 years later, it's probably time for a little change up. And I have noticed a number of podcasts that have a much shorter introduction. They play maybe 15 seconds of music and they talk over 10 of it. So we're going to try something to get you the content sooner.
Well, and I'll tell you, for a while, I thought about it's probably time to change it up. And I was trying to figure out what that's going to look like. And then when you brought it up the other day or yesterday, I was like, you know what? Let's just do short and sweet.
Short and sweet. Less is more, as I learned in marketing.
See, shorter intro, more Technorama.
Because everybody wants more. Apparently, nobody wants more of that. But we're all going to try. It never hurts. That's what this podcast is about. It's a grand experimentation. We test, we learn, we try, we exchange ideas, and you guys are wonderful for being there with us. Let's do the listener feedback. We got some listener feedback. So
here's where we spend our hour and a half. Minute and a half.
We got to get these singers going.
Yeah.
Reach right out and pull one out. Because we all sing along with this. Letters.
Letters. A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Today's letter is R.
Today's show is brought to you by R.
What's a pirate's favorite letter?
B.
The C. I think I got that from a taxi driver. I don't remember where. Because everybody always goes, R, and they go, no, it'd be the C.
We have
a real live postcard from our friend Jorga in Belgium. See if I can get some light reflection off of that a little bit and kind of quasi-infocused. That'll work. It's a lovely stone tower that I can't pronounce somewhere in Belgium with some flowers. And it simply says on the back, Happy Holidays.
Happy holidays.
It's been sitting on the mixer for a while.
Oh.
And we've been on vacation in a while. It takes a couple of weeks for postcards to get over here and over there. So I got that going for me. Then we were on vacation. Hey. Then I was on a business trip. Then we're on another vacation. Last week.
Well, you know what's funny is, you know, when we stopped in the Caymans and went to hell and back.
Yes.
And I had to throw that in there. Everybody throws in the hell joke. But we went to hell. We sent Harrison a postcard. Much better. We sent Harrison a postcard from hell. And it arrived, I think, like a week and a half after we all got back from the cruise.
Julie told me she got her Panama and Costa Rica postcards. What, today? Yesterday? What did she say? It was real recent. And we sent those out, not right away. It was maybe a week ago, I think. So, postal, sometimes it's fast and sometimes not.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny. It took that long.
We also had a question of the week last time. Our question of the week is, what video game had a major impact on your life. I posted that to Facebook yesterday, and we have 58 comments, which we will not have time to read all through all of them. But do you want to pick out a few favorites, Craig?
Yeah. So I'll start from the top.
Okay.
I'll just go for a few. Kevin Cummings says Loom and Mass Effect.
Michael Slobodnik, our coworker, says Wolfenstein 3D and TIE Fighter. I'll go back even further and say the original Wolfenstein and the original Ultima on the Apple IIe. We have
I would have to say Wolfenstein and maybe Doom, because those two were like, I mean, even though as crude as they look today, they were so cool back then.
They were first like 3D first person shooters. Duke Nukem was up there as well.
Yeah.
Those were fun. Those are very addicting.
Yeah. So Barbara Walton says Civilization, all of them.
Dan Letha says Joust.
Yeah. Joust. Pac-Man. JT Shea says Duke Nukem 3D. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with that game.
What else?
Was a lot of fun.
Terry Taylor just says Atari 2600. Tommy hit me so hard that my collarbone still hurts when it rains.
Wow.
His older brother Tom. I just realized that's my brother-in-law Tommy's referring to. Brother-in-law's brother. Terry was a year older than me in high school, so very, very close family thing going on there.
Well, yeah, you know, if you take it a step back and say and think of some of the things like the Atari 2600 instead of just a specific game, I would say that made a big impact on me, because we got that as a family, and we all played together. Not much, that in itself was good, but it's just so much fun that it actually brought to us all, you know.
Bob Alexander says none. Apparently Bob Alexander doesn't play video games.
Yeah, wow.
Shinobi from Dave Ellis. Meridian 59 from Scott Gallatin. Justin Deal says Shadowrun on the Super NES. Yeah.
Our buddy Gary Lindrow says Galaga. Too geeky. No, it's not too. Hey, what is too geeky for this show? We're crying out loud.
Jonathan Ladd says Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2. This is interesting. Jill Weingarten says none, but I enjoy Centipede. Well, there you go. Gary Wandresh, Coleco Football. Yeah. He even put a picture up. Oh my gosh.
I was upset. I never had one, but I had friends that all, you know, had one at school, and I'm just like, wow, I really wanted to get that. But they, you know, a lot of those Mattel games I thought were really cool, even though they were all pretty much the same with a dash, you know, going down the field, whether it was
there
hockey,
were, there
soccer.
Were two footballs. There was this white one that was more rectangular, and then there was the
tan one.
The tan one had, I forget who made the tan one. I don't remember if it was, I think one was Coleco and one was Mattel. And I think you might have got his pictures mixed up here, but I'm not going to.
Oh, hold on. Here you go.
Oh, wait. Oh, the Merlin. He's got his Merlin.
Yeah, my Merlin. Did you, did you ever have one?
No, I never had a Merlin.
Man, this one actually does not work. I bought it off eBay, hoping to throw batteries in it and play it, but.
We got a couple of Dragon's Lair up here.
Yeah, Dragon's Lair is. It kind of made an impact on me because I fell in love with Don Bluth over that. I love his art in Space Ace.
Dave Delaney has Ballyhoo, which is an Infocom game. And Phil Rossi writes back, Infocom! Oh, man. Best Text Adventures Interactive Fiction Adventure were 1976. Dan Slaughter writes, oh, man, he writes a whole paragraph, but he basically put Adventure.
Adventure.
Adventure on the 2600. Oh,
yeah. Would a text game like Infocom be considered a video game? I guess you could sort of.
Yeah, right? Theater of the Mind. We'll go with that.
Yeah, because I think I'd have to say Dave Delaney, he's posted Ballyhoo on here. I fell in love with Infocom. I played probably almost all of them, if not all of them. But
which ones did you play at the arcade? What did you actually put money into?
Me?
Yeah.
Tron. Discs of Tron.
Tron,
Pac-Man.
Tron, and more Tron. Tron, yeah. Battle Zone.
I cannot get enough of
Centipede.
I cannot get enough of Tron.
Centipede, Joust. Those were probably the big four that I was at least moderately good enough to play. I did play Tempest a little bit.
Ms. Pac-Man was big for me as well.
I didn't play much Ms. Pac-Man until I learned how to jury-rig the coin box and play it for free.
Whoa. It's a side of Chuck I didn't know existed. Whoa.
Oh, yes, you did. We've had this story before. Yeah, the bed coat hanger trick. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I could name video games off. I was just so fascinated with video games for a long time, not only because there were so, this is your variety, but just I wanted to make them, you know, but
yeah.
I kind of did, in a sense, on my Commodore when I started trying to calculate a stupid sprite. Huh?
We played Dig Dug considerably. Where you're digging down in the dirt. And the
greatest action move video game ever.
Yeah.
Tapper.
No. I played that on the Apple a lot. What was you kind of segued into now name some really bad video games besides the typical E.T. and Superman and Journey games on the Atari 2600 really had some bad ones, but arcade
that should
games.
Be our question of the week. Well, I'm going to change up the question of the week. What do you think the worst video game ever was?
You know everybody's going to say E.T.?
No, besides E.T.
Yeah, okay, besides E.T.
I'm going to save this question that I got in here for next week.
Take out the low-hanging fruit. Okay, we're going to ask another question at the end of the show. Oh, is that at the end of the game?
Yeah, end of the game.
This is nothing but a game. All right, thank you for everybody who wrote in. We had a blast reading through those yesterday and today. We should change that typewriter.
Yeah.
That means it's time for history. All right, kid. Bueller, it's time for history. History 101. We don't have to roll for this one. Brian's not here today. It's on this day in history for February 27, 2019. Hey, this is my mom's birthday on the 27th.
Happy birthday, Mom.
I better give her a call when this show comes out. This is the 58th day of the year in the Gregorian calendar. There are 307 days remaining, and they're going faster every time we do this show. It's like, whoa.
Hey, by the way, I've already called your mom. Don't worry about it.
Oh, good. Send her an email. I already hacked her email. It was on this date in 425 that the University of Constantinople is founded by Emperor Theodosius the II at the urging of his wife, Elia Eudoxia.
You had an easy one. Here we go. Also today in 1594, Henry IV is crowned King of France.
Wait till we get to the birthdays, kiddo. 207 years ago today, poet Lord Byron gives his first address as a member of the House of Lords in the defense of Luddite violence against industrialism in his home country of Nottinghamshire.
And February 27th, 1900, the British Labour Party is founded.
And they had Labour Day, right?
Yeah, they were into labor.
Oh, okay. A challenge to the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution allowing women the right to vote is rebuffed by the Supreme Court of the United States in Leeser versus Garnett on this date in 1922. Shame on them.
That's right. It was also on this date in 1940 that Martin Kamen and Sam Rubin discover carbon 14.
And then they both tried to figure out how old they were.
That's what I'm saying. But it was everywhere.
I just rethought that last one. It was a challenge to the 19th Amendment, and it was rebuffed. So, good. Good on them. Not bad on them. That same date in 1964, the government of Italy asked for help to keep the Leaning Tower of Pisa from toppling over. Help! Help us hold it up! Happy birthday goes on this date to Italian composer, director, historian, and geographer Pietro Gnocchi, born on this date in 1689. I think they named a little pasta dish after him.
Did they? Edward Belcher, British naval officer, hydrographer. I don't think I've used that word in my life before. An explorer was born on the same date in 1799.
With a name like Belcher, you know what he was good at.
Mm-hmm.
Born February 27th, 1887, Russian captain, pilot, and engineer Pyotr Nesterov.
And Charles Herbert Best, American-Canadian physiologist and biochemist, co-discovered insulin, was born on the same date in 1899.
And if you don't think this deck is stacked, I'm getting all of the good ones today. Russian physicist and academic Yuli Borisovich Cardatin was born 115 years ago today. That just hurts saying it.
And here's another tough one. Kelly Johnson, the American engineer, co-founder of Skunk Works, was born 109 years ago today.
They made a lot of cool stuff in the Skunk Works. Yeah. Like the X-15 and I believe the SR-71 were part of that program.
I believe you're right.
Born February 27, 1932, English-American actress and humanitarian Elizabeth Taylor.
And also born on that same date in 1934, American lawyer, politician, and activist Ralph Nader.
Hey, she has the same name as my mom, and she was born exactly 3 years before my mom. How about that?
Your mom's name is Ralph Nader?
No, Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, okay.
I said she. Also, turning 79 today is American actor Howard Hessman. Johnny Fever is 79? Wow.
Johnny Fever. And also born on the same date in 1947, American physicist and cosmologist Alan Gutmann.
This isn't getting any easier.
I was looking at Hessman at the top. I'm sorry, Alan Guth.
Italian car designer Walter De Silva is 68.
I'm sorry, I was thinking of Howard Hessman. I kept thinking of Booger.
No, not Booger.
No, Booger is what he said that on the radio. That's why he got fired from his previous job.
I thought you meant from...
No, he said it on the radio and got in trouble. He got in trouble for it on the radio.
Okay.
On WKRP, you don't watch the show. American singer-songwriter Johnny Van Zant is 60 today.
You skipped over Neil Sean.
And Neil Sean is also 54... also born on the same date in 1954. American rock guitarist, singer-songwriter... Neil Sean.
I know he played with Journey for a while. All right, and you talked about Johnny Van Zandt. That means I get 1962, which makes him 57 today. Adam Baldwin.
And, we were jumping over bullet points here. English industrial designer, chief designer, and of the beautiful and often replicated Johnny Ive is 52 today.
This is the... inspired design of the Technorama podcast.
His parents.
His parents were inspired to design him.
Whoa, hello.
Also turning 39 today, 39, get this, 39, American journalist and academic Chelsea Clinton. Wasn't she just 39, like 14 wow. years old? Like 25 years ago?
I always thought she was 14, yeah.
when her dad was in office, yeah. But that was 25 years ago. Listener birthdays today include the 28th, actually this week, Wayne, your ad here, Bender, from Bethlehem, PA. I love that. And that's on the funny. 29th, who doesn't happen this year, is Paul Dove, a.k.a. Elmer from Malmesbury, UK. Happy birthday to all of you. That's the way it was on this day in history for February 27th, 2019. It's the end of the music. Score.
So Paul Dove is like 14 or something or whatever.
We got another one of these Wayback Machine things coming up soon. If you want to get your name on the birthday calendar, go over to chuckchat.com/wiki. It's where you can add your name for totally free. We'll give you a shout out at the appropriate time of year. If it's your birthday and you're not on the calendar, well, happy birthday to you. We wish you all the best. We really, really do. But we need to move on with the rest of the show. We have news.
Good news, everyone.
It's National Day of Unplugging coming up March 1st and 2nd. How can you have a national day that's 2 days? Wouldn't that be National Days of Unplugging? What is this?
I think it's 24 hours. So,
sundown to sundown. Okay, so it's sundown March 1st to sundown March 2nd.
Well, see, I want to know how unplugged you have to be because you can't set an alarm for when you can get back online.
A 24-hour global respite from technology. IT highlights the value of disconnecting from digital devices to connect with ourselves, our loved ones, and our communities in real time. Wish they would have done this while I was on a cruise. It's real easy then.
Real easy to do what?
Unplug.
Oh, to unplug?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways I did when we were on the cruise. I didn't really get online. We texted Harrison. That was the only online thing we had to do. But, we got a 16-year-old at home by himself.
In a way, so, you were keeping in touch with your family. So that doesn't count. You know,
I didn't post pictures. I didn't get online. I didn't check really anything. So, no, it didn't count.
Pledge to hashtag unplug. Host an event. An unplug youth. Okay. We help with corporate events, too. Introduce a little work/life balance into your organization. So what is the point? What actually constitutes unplugging?
I think it's just re-engaging with the world without having to post pictures about everything you're doing every 2 minutes and what you're freaking eating.
It's a selfie of actually, me eating with my
you know
family.
What, you know what sucks?
How
you
are
know
you supposed to prove it if you can't put it on social media? If it's not on the internet, it didn't happen.
Well, here's my little quandary. I love being online. I love social media. I love podcasting. But at the same time, I also feel very good when I do disconnect and reengage with people. So I feel, you know, I feel like, oh, this is awesome. But then there's times I'm like, well, I'm just as guilty as everybody else wanting to be online. So,
and then there's times when you're sitting at the restaurant just staring at each other because there's nothing to say because you don't know what's happening.
We already texted each other everything we know.
We've been married 30 years. How many stories can we tell?
Right. But anyway, I think it's a good thing. I've actually often thought of when in the future will actually engaging be the opposite. I mean, everybody would be so engaged online that they'll have parties and stuff to reconnect with people without any technology.
I think
that's
what they're trying to do. With
reject. Yeah. I mean, at what point will it be kind of rejected that technology, you know, cause right now you look at people staring at their phones and I'm like, you should be paying attention. This is the time you should be paying attention to the show you're watching or whatever.
It should be if used responsibly, you use the technology and social media to set up a face-to-face like we do with the podcast meetups.
Yeah.
Then you get some FaceTime with a bunch of great people.
Well, even when we're at Dragon Con, you know, we get on our phones and stuff, but that's the time
I'm
trying to engage with my friends. Yep. Yeah. It's one time we're hanging out with our friends and talking face-to-face. So that's what I'm saying. I just thought in the future, when will it be like the hipster attitude to actually reconnect rather than being online or doing stuff.
The retro movement.
Yeah, it'll be a retro party. Oh, let's reconnect.
Let's get online. Does anybody still get online?
I remember when you used to use smartphones. Oh.
How do you connect to the internet? That was a question through the 90s.
Right. Yeah.
And the 80s.
Oh my gosh. Yes. What's this internet thing?
Yeah. Before it's about 1995.
Oh, I remember a guy tried to tell me it was a fad.
I like the fact that you don't have to explain podcasts anymore. They've become just part of the culture. I haven't explained what a podcast is in probably 3 years.
I think that question is a lot. Yeah, it's a lot fewer and far between.
Because a lot of the major news outlets have it and they say, hey, catch our podcast, you know, wherever you find podcasts.
You're right.
And we were watching Manifest and the guy says, hey, I have a podcast. I want you to be on it. This is just part of the conversation. Like, that's cool. It was sort of like back in the 90s, the first time you saw a website on a commercial. Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's becoming mainstream. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of mainstream, right. I'm sure a lot of you saw the ad about the news about the Nike with the shoe sole blowout.
Right.
And,
that's right.
We're not covering that story. We have another Nike story. a little more up our alley about technology. Go ahead, Greg. Yeah. Take it away.
So Nike users are experiencing some technical difficulties, which is funny because we're talking about their shoes here.
Technical difficulties. These aren't the Marty McFly shoes, are they?
So let me explain.
Okay.
So in the wide world of connected footwear, Nike's $350 Apt BB sneakers are the latest in the company. How you like that name?
$350 shoes.
That's not the crazy part here. So the sneakers are the latest in the company's line of self-lacing shoes.
Okay.
And they come with a Nike Adapt app for Android and iOS. Uh-huh. The app pairs with the shoes and lets you adjust the tightness of the laces, customizing the lights. Yeah, there are lights on there. And see how much battery you have left in your shoes.
I'm kind of wanting some of these now.
Yeah. The only problem is Nike's Android app didn't work. So Android users report that the new kicks are not pairing with the app properly. And some customers are reported failed firmware updates to the shoe.
You can only one shoe at a time.
Yeah, which renders them unpaired. Yeah, I can only get the left one. Which render them unable to pair with the shoe at all. So the Nike app on Google Play has been flooded with one-star reviews in response to a faulty update. So one user writes, the first software update for the shoe threw an error up while updating. That's not a good sign. Bricking the right shoe The app will only sync with the left shoe and then fails time.
Yeah. You have brick shoes.
Yeah. So also app says left shoe is already connected to the other device whenever I try to reinstall and start over. Which I think is kind of funny because if you think, like, I've got earbuds, right? They're wireless earbuds.
Yeah.
Wireless. And they actually talk to each other, and one of them actually talks to the Bluetooth. I don't think they both are Bluetooth. They might be. But I can take one out and one of them. They both work individually. So why can't they figure out how to do shoes like this?
My left shoe won't even reboot. Ah, there's a pun in there somewhere about shoes and boots.
I know. It's ridiculous. So I, you know what? I'm going to go with just shoes that I can just slip on myself.
If they were a little cheaper, I'd be interested. If somebody offered me a gift certificate and said, here, you can get some Beats headphones or these shoes, I'd get the shoes.
Well, I did see a video demo review of them because I was curious about how they work.
Yeah.
And I thought it was kind of neat. And I was like, it wouldn't be too bad. I'd give it a shot. So I'm with you in some respects, but you know, I just think it's kind of funny that.
Is the assumption that the iOS people have no problem?
Yes, that's what it said. The Android app apparently was throwing errors when they were doing this. So I bet they develop on iOS.
This is kind of reminiscent of the recent episode of Bells in the Bat Free.
Oh, I haven't listened to it.
Oh, you have to listen. Arnie comes up with some smart shoes. You just talk to them and they'll do what you say. You got to listen to it. It's one of his typical bad punchlines at the end, but it's worth sure. it. Alrighty.
Anyway, the shoes did look neat.
They look nice. Yeah. And they got bells and whistles on them. So, all right. Quick break time.
Sure.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with Hacks and Strange Stories. And remember when, and we have a geek library, so stick around. We also have all of our thank yous to our patrons. Be right back.
Hi, my name is Julia Pose, and I'm 11 years old. I love gymnastics and karate. I have to go to school, and I do all the other things normal kids do. But I'm more than that. I'm a geek. I listen to Technorama Podcast. It helps me to maintain my inner geek. For your own inner geek, just go to www.chuckchat.com/Technorama. I'm ready for my download, Mr. Tomasi.
Hi, this is Erin Gray, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
I just realized, when's the last time we edited this show?
Edited the show?
Yeah.
Well, probably a long time ago.
Yeah, a really long time ago. And also realized that Julia Pose was 11 years old in 2007.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's probably married with children by now.
I know she does have her dad did point me to her webpage. She's into acting and production, and not surprised based on how her childhood was going. So very, very exciting to see some of these kids grow up. My kids grew up.
Yeah.
What happened to my kids?
Just like us. We're still growing up.
Maybe.
I'm never growing up, but
well, you have to grow old, but you don't have to grow up. Let's do the Hacks and Strange Stories thing because I like this one.
Do you?
From Oddity Central, Japanese artist gets barbecue fans all fired up with skull-shaped charcoal. If you're looking to give your backyard barbecue a macabre touch, these charcoal skulls created by Japanese artist Sekisadamu are sure to do the trick. When Sekisadamu, I hope I'm saying that approximately close, it's got the right letters in the right order at least, came up with the idea for his creepy charcoal skulls, he never really thought about commercial potential. He merely wanted something cool to show off at the recently concluded Wonder Festival in Chiba, Japan. But after posting photos of his creation on Twitter and inviting people to the festival to check out them in person. He got an overwhelming response, over 13,000 likes and almost 9,300 retweets at the time of this writing, and started contemplating the idea of making charcoal skulls for the masses. The Japanese artist was already announced that he had set up a domain name for them and begun procedures to register a trademark on them. So fire up your grill, because charcoal skulls are coming. Not only do they show pictures of the charcoal skulls in the fire, but they right. have them in the box, so they look fairly small. I mean, they're not human skull-sized charcoal. Those would take forever to burn.
I imagine they're... Yeah, they got to be kind of small.
And they look pretty gruesome after they're all burned up, too.
Hey, actually, I thought that was a scene from, like, Terminator.
It does kind of look like...
Yeah. I'm waiting for a robot to come rolling over them with treads. It is pretty
apocalyptic. Now, I remember Michael Menengay sent me a picture, not of charcoal skulls, but it was just like, I forget whether they were the stone ones that you put in a regular fire pit and then the flames come out through the eyes and whatnot. And they were pretty gruesome. Those, they were bigger.
Don't you have you had a marble thing out there with fire? You should put one, one right in the middle.
I have a fire pit, but I'm not going to put these human skull charcoals in them.
Just get a regular
skull human
and put
skull?
It right there with fire, so a fire would come out the front.
I could get a crystal skull, and then Indiana Jones would show up.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. All right. We have another bad use of technology, in my opinion. Well, maybe it's a creative use. Your turn.
I think creative is more of it. So the story of a young student who used a so-called handwriting robot, in air quotes, to complete her Lunar New Year holiday homework in record time made news headlines in China this week, sparking a heated debate.
Okay.
The Quiyang Evening News reported the case of a junior high school student of Harbin who spent 800 yuan? How do you say that? 800 won? 118 bucks. on a copying robot that allowed her to complete her transcribing assignments and essays in no time at all. The girl's mother, surname Yizhang or Zhang, became suspicious when her daughter turned in her holiday homework neatly written with absolutely no errors, despite having very little time to do it due to Lunar New Year festivities and traveling. Then, while cleaning the girl's room, Zhang found a bizarre metal contraption, as well as its packaging, which claimed that it could imitate any handwriting. So, first rule of thumb: get rid of the packaging so you don't get caught,
and hide this thing under your bed. It lays flat.
What she should have done is bought an Okidata printer and just set it on. Tell her mom I was repairing it.
It looks like it's got an Oki stepper motor on it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. If you had a printer sitting there, I was just fixing this printer.
After her daughter admitted using the device to complete her holiday homework a lot faster, the woman reportedly broke it and took it to social media to complain that her girl's deceitful tactic. It can help you with homework, but it can't help you on tests, Zhang was quoted as saying. That's not the point. Now, think about this. This would be bring this into a meeting sometime. Do your voice dictation. just put it up so it's got voice dictation, and then it feeds into the robot and just takes notes for you.
You know what? Everybody's like bringing laptops and tablets in to take notes during meetings. Set this down and take about 5 minutes. Hey, take about 5 minutes to wire it up and then plug it up to your USB and then.
Right. What are you doing? I'm just taking notes.
Yeah. Keep going. Yeah, it's all writing down what you're saying.
The woman's post went viral online, with some commenters recalling their own school experience and wishing they had a handwriting robot to help them. Of course, we all wish we had handwriting home robots. Sometimes educators need to reflect on this issue, which is why we still need to do a task that can be completed by a robot. They've got other pictures on here. If you go through the show notes, shows you very neatly written Chinese handwriting, English, typical English handwriting, and some drawings.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're talking, Chuck and I are very American. We assume that looks like neatly written Chinese. I guess it is.
Well, she's from China. I'm going to make that assumption. Hey,
and it is straight. Okay, so it looks good to me.
Okay, yeah. So, hey, I'm all for the imagination and taking advantage of technology where you can. Make your life easier.
You know what the problem is they needed to add a little randomization to the placement of the character, so it looks like somebody just, you know, maybe adjusted a little bit up and down, so it looks kind of random.
Even if you taught it how to make the different letters in your own font, if every letter were consistently consistent, which I know that's redundant, but that's, there's a point for that, then it would still look unnatural. Normal human handwriting, I don't make the letter R the same twice. Even if they're right next to each other. I noticed that today. I was making out CDs at church, and I made a P, and then a couple of letters later, I made another P, and they were different.
I have noticed that in my own handwriting, like writing the number two. Sometimes I do a loop, you know, where it goes around, or sometimes I've done a straight. Yeah,
The Z.
You know, cut back. Yeah, cut back. You know.
I rarely do a looped.
I don't know. Sometimes I do. I don't, even an eight, instead of doing two circles, sometimes I'll do the figure eight, and just, I don't know why I do that.
Do you change your style from time to time? I recently changed the way I make lowercase d's.
I have done that in the past, but I don't really think about it much anymore. Maybe I should. Now I will. Thanks.
Oh, I also think about the people that were influenced by my handwriting style. So I make a capital A, and I go, oh yeah, I got that from my buddy Dan back in high school. You know, I see the...
Thanks for the font.
The font inspiration. I get my D's from Donna. They probably don't look like her D's, but my D's look more like her D's now than when we first met.
I think Donna has had plenty of experience writing D's.
Right. And that's why mine look more like hers.
Nobody does a K like me.
That just strikes me as something on a bumper sticker or a t-shirt.
Right.
Nobody does a K like me. People are going to look at you like, what is that? Is that a new drug or something?
You know, I may just do that. Make it just for that. What? Huh? What?
Just stick that on Facebook randomly one day. People go, what?
That's right.
Weird audio clips that we're just going to take out of context. All right. We want to give a shout out to our chat room. Somewhere I thought we had chat room music. Did we ever put? We never did. Okay. Well, let's see who's in the chat. We've got Clinton Alford. We've got Scott Tyler. John Miller Jr. has been chiming in. Thank you. Thank you very much. Again, we do this every Sunday night that we can at 9:30 Eastern time. If you subscribe to our Facebook page at facebook.com/Technorama Podcast, you will get notifications when we are live. And then when we're not, you can go watch TV or your favorite show.
Like Ralph Wengler.
Ralph was on the cruise with us. CJ is on there. I wonder if they're... I picture Ralph and CJ sitting on the couch on their laptops watching Technorama next to each other instead of sharing a laptop.
That's funny since they're in two different states.
What? They are.
Ralph was there?
Ralph was local.
I thought he lived in Oklahoma. Yeah.
All right. Well, then I'm all mixed up. Maybe they're visiting each other in my alternate reality. Michael King is in there. I can still picture it, man. Tim Elliott, CJ, Doug Schultze was in here for a while. All right, we got some Diane Chandler. We got some coworkers. I did have one of my coworkers in India tell me on Thursday's weekly status call, I watched your Technorama podcast. And go, oh, boy.
Yeah, here it comes. I have some feedback for you, Charles.
I said, this is the beast that started it all.
Yeah.
He helps me with IoT. I'll help him with podcasting.
By the way, Ralph said it's like Chuck's reality. Yeah.
Hey. Adam Savage always used to say, I reject your reality and substitute my own.
That's right. That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
Okay. That brings us to Remember When, which I believe is down here. Yes, we have the Remember When music going, so.
Yeah, we got to remember to talk over it so we don't get busted.
That's right. It's cool to spool again.
Is it?
According to this article, sales are soaring and current stars are releasing tracks on the format. But is anyone actually listening to them? I got a dubbing deck still here in the studio. It came with the house. That's going to be my t-shirt motto.
Yeah. If it's here, thank Mike.
Right. Pause. Stop. Rewind. The cassette, long consigned to the bargain bin of musical history, is staging a humble comeback. Sales have soared in the last year, up 125%. That means I sold five of them. In 2018, on the year before, amounting to more than 50,000 cassette albums bought in the UK, the highest volume in 15 years. It's quite a fall from the format's peak in 1989 when 83 million cassettes were bought by British music fans. But when everyone from pop superstar to Ariana Grande to punk duo Sleaford Mods, I don't know that I listened to either of them, but I'm old, so we'll go with that, are taking to tape, a mini revival seems afoot. But why? Quote, it's the tangibility of having this collectible format and a way to play music that isn't just a stream or download. Yes, so you can make a suitcase size full of these things in your car.
Yeah. You know, I love cassettes because it was the medium that I had to work with and a long time ago doing some of the things that I wanted to do. And I enjoyed them back then, but I don't know if it's something I really need to go back and revisit.
Some of my earliest audio hijinks were on cassette.
Oh, yeah.
Some were on reel to reel, if you want to go back that far.
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to do, I mentioned this before, I used to do, before I learned how to use turntables to do mixing,
yep.
You know, DJing, I would have two tape decks feeding into a third to record. So the third one would be recording.
You're high-tech. And
So I had the same song on two tapes and I would flip back and forth and I mix them and it was complicated, but me and my friend Mark figured out how to do it. We had little Y adapters, had all them feeding. Not a mixer.
Never
we had
mind
y
about adapters. DB loss.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying the recordings were great, but they worked. And we were able to do mixes. And we found that we played the same song at the same time.
Yes.
And sometimes you'd have to tap the pause on one of them. You could get this flanging effect because one of the motors is always not the same speed, even though the tape decks were the same model.
Yep.
It's always slightly off. So you go and have this effect when the songs, and if you do it right, it would work. But anyway, there was a lot of things we figured out how to do. I love the medium, but I don't know if I want to get back there.
No, I really don't think so. It's not where I'm going. They did have a sound. People can compare this to vinyl if they want, but you know, saying vinyl has this authentic, warmer sound. Cassette had its own.
Vinyl's different. I like vinyl, but
cassette had its own characteristic sound as well.
I also hated backup tapes. They break.
Backup tapes.
Yeah, tapes, real.
Oh, you mean from data backups, like in a data center? Oh,
tapes. I think
yes.
I think tapes in general was a bad idea. Just it sucked.
They jammed.
They stretch.
Hey, well, you know what? There's a secondary market that's also going to make a big comeback, and that's pencils.
Yeah, they're on the way.
If cassette
we're going from
sales
number
are
two to number three,
I'm going to invest some stock money in Dixon Ticonderoga right now.
Hey, I'll tell you something else. It was funny. I was at a light the other day, and I went to turn, and I happened to look across the road at the where we're, you know, kind of curb gravel area.
Yeah.
And I saw a cassette, the tape just sitting there in the wind, you know, sitting there. I was like, wow, how long has it been since I've seen that on the side of the road? You know, people used to throw their cassettes out when they break and you see like a gnarly tangled mess. I saw that the other day. I was like, whoa.
Sort of that cassette tape tumbleweed thing.
I had to look at it twice. I went, wait a minute. Did I just see what I thought I saw? Yeah, I sure did.
Go back, take a picture.
Hey, by the way, Stephen Weshey in the chat room says, you can buy Bluetooth cassette adapters. Yes, I did have one.
Oh, my goodness.
I had one because when I bought my new Beetle in 2003, the guy asked me, hey, do you want CD? You want a CD magazine that goes on the back? I was like, why? I've got an iPod. You know, so no, I'm fine. So I did end up eventually moving to a Bluetooth cassette adapter, which was marginal at best at the time. I'm sure they're better now, but you know, that was several years ago. And it kind of sucked, but then I ended up with a tape adapter with the cord hanging out so I could just hook up the,
I had numerous of those cassette adapters with the 1/8-inch jack that comes out.
Yeah.
And the wire would break after about a year, or some connection would go bad, and you start getting half the channel or tinny music.
That was,
going.
But that was better than Bluetooth back in the day. Now, I'm sure Bluetooth, I mean, I have no trouble with Bluetooth at all anymore.
Unless it comes to your shoes.
Yeah. Sorry, Nike. Too soon?
Way too soon. Also, not too soon. You want to do the next one on the Apple IIe?
Yes.
I really want to build one of these now.
Oh, and you got the materials.
Got pretty much everything I need to build one of these.
Yeah. So when most people decide they want to build a robot, they start with some sort of kit or something. Super elite makers might take a more granular approach and build it from scratch using some sort of microcontroller board as the brain. But Michael Cohn is the most, he is the most people. No, he isn't most people and went completely bonkers route. He went to the completely bonkers route of turning a vintage Apple IIe into a robot rover.
The whole chassis runs around. The one thing I fault him on his video, he says, like, load robot. And then he says, run. It's like, dude, you can just say run robot.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true.
What's up with that?
Maybe he had to learn. So to be clear, Cohn didn't just use the Apple IIe to control the robot, but rather he used it as a robot himself. Not only did he mean, did that mean he had to make the Apple IIe portable, a feat in its own right, because there is no battery. You have to hook it up a cord, but it also had to get it to control the motors to drive it. In order for the Apple IIe to run on batteries, Cohn had to remove the original power supply, replace it with 14.8 volt LiPo batteries and regulators for various power rails.
Yep.
So you can see it obviously in the show notes.
There's a still picture on the screen right now. And he does have some external circuitry there for various motor controls and whatnot.
And double points for having a sword.
The plastic knife. That's my favorite part.
Yeah. It comes a little stabby sword. Right. It's like it's on a stabby, on a stepper motor or two. And it's like,
it's on a little servo motor.
There you go. And finally, to add an extra bit of flair to the robot, Cohn added a servo arm while wielding a 3D printed sword and voice synthesizer so the robot can speak.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Out of my way. Hack, hack.
You have 10 seconds to comply.
That's a lot of fun. That is straight up Technorama right there.
I'm one up him. I'm going to do this with a Commodore 64.
Go for it. Proof that you don't need a lot of horsepower to run a robot, that I believe, if memory serves, the 6502 is around 1 megahertz. It was not a high power machine. It only has like 3 registers in the CPU.
Yeah, you don't need, I'm doing some stuff. I know it's obviously more powerful than that, but I'm doing some stuff with a tiny VM in Amazon's cloud.
Yeah.
And it just runs some cron job and does a few other things. It's very small. It doesn't do a whole lot. You don't need a lot of horsepower to do some really amazing things.
Nope. I want to reach out to this guy and see if I can get a hold of him just to get some more info on what he did and how he did it. That would be fun.
You know, I'm sorry. This reminds me, any Rick and Morty fans out there, Rick made that little robot that his purpose was to get butter. Go over and pull the butter dish over to him. And he says, he asked Rick, his creator, what is my purpose? Your purpose is to get butter. Oh, it's like, it's your purpose in life. That's it.
You, that Marvin had it rough on Hitchhikers.
Yeah. Oh, now he's depressed.
Speaking of depressed, no, we're not depressed. Where's the music? We are happy. We are thrilled. We are excited that we have patrons that help with the funding of this show. Thank you very much. Because
we're exuberated. There's another one.
Because of you, this show continues. Because of you, we have funding for the website and bandwidth, etc.
And because of you, it's your fault.
So, huge shout out to you. You get your name enshrined on the list. People like Kyle Nishioka, Abner Braverman, Ben Vaughn, Mike Wills, Megapodtastic, Night Gig Studios, Gary Lindros, we thank you all. John Clifford, Leon, John Noble, Chris MC.
Whoa, back up. That not John Noble?
Our John Noble, yes.
Okay.
Alexis Duran, Saturday Morning Media, Steve Therian, Jorgis Rowan. The music is good thing we got a lot of music because we're getting a lot of people. John Miller Jr., I said Yorga, right? Yes. Yorga, yes. Postcard Schroen. We have a name for every one of you. Amber Elstead, right. Harold McKinstry, Amy Bowen, Denise Inglis. I hope we're saying that close. And our latest and greatest Patreon, as of last week, Stephen Weshy. Thank you very much for...
Weshy!
Not Welshy. but you can cheer him on at the end if you want.
Yeah, Welshy. Weshy.
Stephen Weshy! Thank you very much. If you want to become a Patreon patron for this podcast, you can go over to patreon.com/technoramapodcast. If you're watching on the video, it's right there on the bottom of the screen. See it? See it?
Mm-hmm.
And we have it in the show notes as well. Whoa. I kind of messed with the fader.
It's like, what are you doing?
Fiddling with the mixer while I'm doing the show. They also get not just their name and a shout out for their generous contributions, but they also get for additional show content that we record right after this and we release pretty much right after this.
Yeah, pretty much.
So you get this special content that no one else in the world hears. Our conversations can go anywhere. And you get the whole back lot of everything we've done since day one, the last 3 years or so of these special Patreon shows. If you're curious to find out, you can go over to Technorama Podcast.
Yeah. Actually, I was surprised the other day when we thought about it that we've been doing it for so long.
Yeah, I think we just passed our 3-year mark on that. So thank you very much. I'm going to fade out the Imperial Death March there. And that brings us up to the Geek Library. I still like this music.
Ow. Okay. Your pitch is killing my ear.
I love it when you hit a resonance and you get that harmonics in there. And you go, You hear that underlying.
One day you're gonna hit the right one. I'm just going to fall over.
Scientists finally figured out why grapes spark in the microwave. Because we all want to know this. Plasma. Who knows the reasons why scientists may have for choosing the questions that will shape his life's work. I'm going to make this font a little larger for my older eyes. There we go. Maybe when pondering life's great mysteries, he prefers the guidance of physics to that of religion. Maybe he's always dreamed of circling the Earth in the International Space Station, watching the sunrise every 90 minutes over the soapy blue of his home planet. Maybe he accidentally put a fork in the microwave one time, or maybe he's in the microwave thing but with a grape. Quote, in 1995, Trent University physicist Aaron Slepkov, sounds like one of the names from our birthday, had found his first website describing making plasma in a microwave, and he got really fascinated with it and kept it in the back of his mind, co-author Pablo Bianucci told me when I called to ask about a paper he, Slepkov, an undergraduate student named Hamza Katak, authored. These names are great.
I'm glad you got this one.
That is out this week in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. The Great Grape Plasma Spark Experiment is underway. And there's a video in here that explains it. The young Slepkov had discovered the old grape in the microwave trick, in which he sliced grape erupts into a fireball of plasma, an ionized gas that is considered the fourth state of matter and is present in large quantities in, among other places, the sun. 20 years later, Slepkov, now a physics professor, took on his own experiment to explain how the phenomenon worked. First off, the rules. From a thorough inspection of the internet's best microwave grape fireball videos, it seemed to be necessary to cut the grape in half before microwaving, leaving a small, ion-rich skin bridge between the two hemispheres. Is this science? If so, I would like to be a scientist.
Okay.
This is what the article from Popular Mechanics is writing. So the commentary is theirs. I won't take credit for it.
Yeah.
Quote, the more or less consensus explained was that the grape would work as an antenna, and that would create a current through the skin bridge that would eventually heat it up and create the plasma, says Bianucci. Though the sacrifice of untold masses of grapes and 12 microwaves, through the sacrifice,
The grapes were harmed in the
microwaves were harmed. Yeah, the researchers showed that this hypothesis, which had never been explained mathematically anyway, was false. Not only is a skin bridge between the grape halves not required, but you could ignite a plasma fireball in two whole grapes placed side by side in a small bowl, or two ground cherries, two quail eggs, or even two hydrogel beads of the types used in diapers.
Hmm.
Okay. I'm sticking diapers in the microwave if you paid me.
Not the dirty ones.
Using microwaves with doors removed, they managed to decouple the generation of the plasma, the really flashy thing you see, from the actual phenomena that's going on underneath, which is focusing on the electromagnetic radiation, the microwaves in between the two hemispheres. All right, there is a video, and they go on with some really cool experiments with glass and a plastic bowl, and it was interesting. They put a plastic, almost like one of those things you get condiments in, whether it's like a package of olives or cheese or something, you know, just a few centimeters high and a few centimeters wide. And they put that over the grapes, elevated on like little stands on pegs. So there was an air gap between the lip of the bowl and the microwave tray. And the grapes created this plasma, and it stayed at the top of the bowl, well, inverted, because it would be the bottom of the bowl. And stay there and actually burned a hole right through the plastic. There's some fun video to watch here. If you're into the destructive stuff, this one's for you.
You know what scared me about this whole article?
What's
and
that?
Maybe it's just I didn't, obviously I don't know a whole lot about how microwaves work per se, but I saw using the microwave with the doors removed. And I was like, what? Why would you ever? I was always told never to do that.
Microwave radiation won't kill you unless you stick your head in the way of the magnetron.
Yeah, but why? I mean, the door has a mesh on the front of it, like a Faraday cage or something.
Right, because you don't want the microwaves getting out. You want them directed at the food you're cooking.
Yeah, I don't want them hitting my head.
All right, don't try this at home, kids.
Maybe it's just for me when I was a kid and we moved into our new house in Texas. Part of moving into the new house, they gave us a microwave. I'd never seen a microwave in my life. So I always thought it was kind of this cool thing, but it's kind of, you know, crazy, mysterious thing that, you know, didn't know how it works. So I remember one time I had some, of course, I would never microwave French fries nowadays, but I was heating up some French fries and it had some aluminum foil on it.
Oops.
And it was going, bzz, bzz. I was like, so me as a, you know, 11-year-old, it scared the crap out of me. I saw sparks flying from the microwave. So I'm like,
I'm not eating those.
My radiated fries, they're no good anymore.
Well, they weren't good. Yeah. Radiator fries are never any good. All right. Truth be told,
they were probably radiated when we purchased them.
To the end of the show. And our question of the week this week is, what do you believe the worst video game ever was?
Your opinion.
What's the worst video game?
Yeah, not consent. You know, whatever you thought was the worst. I'll tell you
one. The worst video game you've ever played. How about that?
Yeah. The one I hated the most I can think of is Rambo on the Commodore. The reason it was Rambo because I was, you know, your character's running. It's not a first-person shooter or anything, but it's top-down.
Yep.
And I'm shooting, and I got to a point. I'm almost done with this level, and I got killed. I had to start all over. There was no saves. There was no, you start close to where you were at or your last touch point or anything. No, you start over the whole thing. I ended up pounding my fist on the desk after, like, the fifth or tenth time I died and broke the... the pressed wood table. it was maddening. I hated that stupid game.
I tried a number of them, and I can't even remember how many dozens of games I went through. Because, you know, in high school and college, there were bootleg games flying left and right. And I remember you'd get this disc with about 10 games on it, and maybe one was playable because A, we didn't have any instructions. B, They often required a joystick, and we didn't have joysticks in the computer lab in school. So, you know, you'd turn on the game, and your little character would just sort of like fall to the bottom of the screen and die. And go, wait, what? How am I supposed to figure this out? So half of the fun was trying to get it to figure out, do you have keyboard controls or not?
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about the E.T. game.
No, that game should just fall on the ground and die anyway.
Hey, John Miller Jr. Steps in and says, Superman 64, easily the worst game to play. Wow. And that's tough coming from a Superman fan, John Miller Jr. is.
We will post that back to the internet next weekend and see what you come up with. Look for that on our Facebook page and elsewhere. So thank you very much, Craig. It's been a riot as always.
No, Charles, thank you. Charles, for allowing me to.
I feel like I'm under arrest or something.
Charles, will you come in here, please?
back to the principal's office.
That's right.
You can find out, or you can contact us on the listener line, 707-530-2428. Thank you very much, Donna. Very helpful. You can contact us at technorama@chuckchat.com. Send us your comments. Send us your corrections to the show. Anything you heard that doesn't make any sense or is blatantly false.
Wait, that's way too open.
And thank you very much to my wife, Donna, for handling all the video again. She gets the Mario coin. Find all our stuff on our website at chuckchat.com. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, Craig, and give us that binary high five.
I tell people about Technorama all the time. 101.